This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Exodus. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Exodus, chapter 1, with today's edition of Sandy Adams Radio.
When we read the creation account in Genesis chapter 1, we come away impressed with God's unlimited scope, with God's unbridled power, God the Creator. And yet God's most spectacular accomplishments are not His creative works. They are His redemptive works. You see, it takes no love to create, but it takes intense love to redeem and to retrieve, and especially when what you're retrieving has rebelled against you. It's interesting that there are only a few chapters in the Bible that are devoted to creation, but this whole book is about redemption. The Bible is the story of how God buys us back, buys back mankind from the slavery of sin. This is also the theme of the book of Exodus. The word Exodus is from two Greek words, ek, or out of, and horos, or the road, the way. Exodus is the road out of bondage. It is the way out, not only of Egyptian bondage, but also the spiritual bondage that some of us remain in, bondage that has been caused by our sin. If you feel trapped, if sin has a vice grip on your life that you can't seem to shake, if you're looking for a way out, then take heart, for Exodus means way out. This is a way out book that'll help you get way out of trouble and out of the bondage that you might be in tonight. This book is for you. And over the next several weeks, we're going to be learning how God wants to bring us out of the bondage of sin and into a life of victory. Well, Exodus opens as Genesis closes. Jacob and his family join Joseph in Egypt. Originally, 70 people settled in the land of Goshen in the northeast corner of Egypt. They planned to wait out the famine, but they never returned home to Canaan. We're told what happened. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man in his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, the 12 sons of Jacob. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. In Numbers chapter 1, a Hebrew census will be taken, and there Moses will count over 600,000 men 20 years old and older at the time of the Exodus. 600,000 men. Add to that number women and children, and that pushes the Hebrew population in Egypt upwards of 2 million, maybe even 3 million people. Egypt at the time was a land of around 7 million people. That means that nearly a third of the country's total population was now of Hebrew descent. And this frightened the Egyptians. I mean, they looked around, and these Hebrew women, they were fertile myrtles. They were having babies left and right. And if this Hebrew baby boom wasn't stopped, the Egyptians would be outnumbered in their own country. Verse 8 tells us, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." This was actually more than just a new king. It was a new dynasty of kings. You remember, Joseph came to power under the Hyksos, or the shepherd kings, foreigners, nomads really, who had invaded Egypt and taken over control. But now the native Egyptians have recaptured the throne, and a new administration shifts its policy toward the Hebrews living in its borders. Jacob's family is no longer going to enjoy this favored nation status that they have previously. And the Pharaoh said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. The Egyptians were fearing a Hebrew uprising. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And you'll find that this always happens when God's people are oppressed and persecuted. They multiply. In the book of Acts, when the church was attacked, what happened? It grew. Persecuting the church was like pouring gas on a fire. It only caused the flame to burn brighter. Under persecution, true believers intensify their commitment. They streamline their service. They bulk up their faith. When persecution strikes, we get serious about our faith. It's in times of ease that we grow flabby. Rather than faith, we gain flab. But under mounting persecution, the church becomes clean and lean and serene, a real witnessing machine. It all happens under persecution. Verse 12 tells us, "And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage." They just poured it on in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. The Jewish historian Josephus says that the Hebrews also built walls within the borders of Egypt. They also built canals throughout the land, and they even built some of the famous pyramids. Yet again, all of this hardship, all of this rigor didn't stunt their growth. They continued to multiply. And so the Pharaoh came up with another plan. You know, you pour on the persecution, they only multiply like rabbits, so let's come up with something else. Verse 15 tells us, "Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, 'When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live.'" Now, the birth stool was an Egyptian innovation in childbirth. In Egypt, women would give birth standing up rather than lying down. They would crouch. I'm not going to demonstrate this, but they would crouch down over two stones or two bricks, and they would push down on the stones. And so the pushing, along with the law of gravity, you know, you got the law of gravity working with you, it sort of helped the child slide down the birth canal, and of course the midwife caught the kid before he hit the ground. Pharaoh, you don't like the idea, do you? Pharaoh had used external hardship to stop the growth of the Hebrews, but to no avail. Now, though, he tries some internal sabotage. He asked the midwives to do the dirty work. When a male child is born, hey, conveniently cause a problem, abort the child. You know, this is also Satan's strategy with the church. If he can't intimidate us from the outside, he'll try to infiltrate us from the inside. He'll send false teachers, selfish shepherds, corrupt midwives, you might say, into the church to sabotage our growth, to abort the new birth that might occur. Beware. If Satan can't hit us from the outside, he'll try to corrupt us from the inside. Verse 17 says, "But the midwives feared God." I like that. I'm sure they feared Pharaoh, but they feared God more. And that's what it boils down to, isn't it? Who do you fear more? And the midwives did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but save the male children alive. Here is a good example of appropriate civil disobedience. When the laws of the land violate God's laws, we need the courage of these Hebrew midwives to obey God rather than men. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?" And they were probably quaking in their boots as they're being interrogated here. I mean, they've been arrested for disobeying the most powerful man on the planet at that time. And the midwife said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they're lively, and they give birth before the midwives come to them. I mean, these Hebrew gals don't play. I mean, like Domino's pizzas, man, they're into speedy deliveries. Before we can get there, the child's been born. Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. God rewarded their obedience. And he did so personally. For so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. Because of their obedience, these two midwives became housewives. God blessed them with husbands and with children of their own. You know, in a spiritual sense, I was thinking about this week. This is also what I have experienced as a pastor. For in a sense, a pastor is a spiritual midwife. You know, it's my job to assist and to help when people are born again, when people are born spiritually into the family of God. And you know, a pastor finds himself caring for and ministering to the households, the families of the church. But you know, in return, God has blessed me with a wonderful family. And I'm so proud of my kids. I'm so in love with my wife and so proud of my wife. It just seems that as I've been going about being a midwife to so many people, God has blessed me with a wonderful family of my own. I'm thankful for that. Verse 22. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, "Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive." Here again, he tries it again. This time he orders all the male babies to be thrown into the Nile River. Now, Josephus says that the Pharaoh's actions were actually prompted by a prophecy, that one of his wise men had predicted that a child was about to be born among the Hebrews who would be raised up and who would deliver God's people. And so Pharaoh's actions specifically were his attempt to wipe out that prophetic deliverer. Well, chapter 2 tells us about that child. And a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. And so the woman conceived and bore a son. Later we learn the couple's name was Amram and Jochebed. And their baby boy was a child named Moses. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. She didn't want him thrown into the Nile River. He was a beautiful baby. She loved him so much, and so she hid him. Again, Josephus, who was a Jewish historian at the time of Christ, he says that Moses was so handsome growing up, that he was such a beautiful child, that while he was living in the court of Pharaoh, people would actually go by out of their way to walk by the nursery just to lay eyes on this kid, admire his good looks. My parents say that they had the same problem with my brother. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23 tells us, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents, because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command." I never knew what an act of faith it was hiding a baby for 3 months. I never knew how much faith that would require until I had a baby of my own. I mean, this took incredible faith. We're going to hide a baby for 3 months? I mean, what if baby Moses wakes up in the middle of the night and he gets hungry and he decides to let everybody know it? What if he burps at the wrong time? What if the kid gets colic? Or what if dad sticks the kid with a safety pin trying to change his diapers? Worse, what if dad sticks himself with a safety pin while trying to change his diapers? What if a scream gets let out? I'm telling you, what happens later at the Red Sea is no more of a miracle than hiding a baby for 3 months. Both were miracles. It's interesting, Josephus tells us that Amram, Moses' father, had a dream at this time, and in it, God told him of the child's destiny that helped motivate him to hide this child. And thus, Hebrews 11, verse 23 reads, "By faith, Moses was hidden." Verse 3. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, dabbed it with asphalt and pitch, in other words, made it waterproof, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister, who later we'll know was Miriam, stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Now, since Pharaoh had ordered all of the male babies thrown into the river, I would have imagined that it would be Jochebed's initial maternal impulse to keep baby Moses as far away from that river as possible, wouldn't you think? You know, it's amazing to me, though, that she takes the baby, puts it in a basket, waterproofs the basket, then brings the basket down to the Nile. Apparently, God had prompted her to do so. He had put it in her heart. You know, it's interesting that God often takes instruments of death, in this case, the Nile River, and turns them into tools of life and deliverance. Another wonderful example is a Roman cross. Well, verse 5 tells us, then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. She sees the basket. She commands her servants to go and fetch the child. Here is an amazing work of God's providence. God overseeing circumstances, working them out according to his purposes. Now, we don't really know the identity of Pharaoh's daughter at the time, but there is a good possibility that she was a girl named Hatshepsut. She was the barren daughter of Amenhotep I, a powerful, politically powerful princess, incidentally. Hatshepsut later became queen, and it could be that she looked on the baby Moses as an heir to the throne, as her heir to succeed her in ruling over Egypt. Cecil B. DeMille's classic movie, The Ten Commandments, you've seen it, I'm sure. Really and truly, it's not that far off historically. DeMille developed the storyline of his movie by weaving together the biblical accounts along with some extra biblical sources, namely Josephus. And so it's really quite accurate. You know, there's an interesting Jewish legend. It comes from the Talmud that tells an interesting story about the baby Moses. I think it's worth repeating. One day, the story goes, while playing on Pharaoh's lap, the child, Moses, grabbed the king's crown and he tossed it on the floor. And then he got down off the Pharaoh's lap and stomped on the crown. Obviously, his actions were prophetic. I mean, the baby's antics were a preview of coming attractions. And the Egyptian magicians, they took this incident seriously. They saw it as an act of treason. And from that day forward, they viewed Moses with a suspicion. The king, though, he sort of laughed the whole thing off as child's play. Well, Pharaoh told the magicians, after they expressed their concern, that if this baby really, you know, if their suspicions were true, if this baby was given a choice, it would prove that it was really just an infantile, you know, it didn't really have much of an intellect, didn't have much of a cognitive reasonings and all going. And so they suggested that he be given a choice between a hot coal and a piece of gold. And the Pharaoh said, hey, this is just a baby. If given a choice between a hot coal and a piece of gold, obviously the baby will choose the hot coal. You know, there's no way. The baby doesn't even know what's valuable and what's not. Well, when they put Moses to this little test, sure enough, the baby grabbed the hot coal and actually stuck it in its mouth as babies do. And the legend goes that the hot coal burned Moses' tongue and caused a permanent speech impediment. And later, when Moses is called by God to go to Egypt, you know, he will use as an excuse, I'm slow of speech, I can't speak, Lord. He'll use this speech impediment as an excuse. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a bit, aren't we? Back at the riverside, verse 6. And when she had opened the ark or the basket, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." And so the woman, and guess who that woman was? It was Jochebed. It was his mother, took the child and nursed him. Here's another act of God's providence. Pharaoh's daughter appoints Moses' own natural mother to nurse him. In ancient times, kids were nursed and breastfed, not for a few months, but for several years. And thus, this gave Jochebed time to teach her son some of God's truth. Well, verse 10 tells us, "And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And so she called his name Moses, saying, 'Because I drew him out of the water.'" The Hebrew word Moshe means to draw out. And so Moses became his name. It's interesting, in Acts chapter 7, verses 21 and 22, Stephen gives us some details into the life of Moses that we really don't get anywhere else. He sort of fills in a gap in Moses' early history. There, Stephen says, "Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds." As the queen's son, Moses was educated in Egypt's finest academies. I mean, he got the kind of education we give kids here at Calvary Chapel Christian School. It was amazing. You know, it's an irony, though. What a sense of humor God shows. Moses was the baby that the Pharaoh was trying to kill. Instead, God works it out where the Pharaoh bankrolls his room, board, and education. God always gets the last laugh. Imagine what this must have been like, though, for Moses. Imagine a child from one of the poorest of the poor families in Haiti. Suddenly, he gets whisked away on a jet airplane. He lands in the White House, and he's adopted by the president and Mrs. Bush. Moses and Bushes seem to go together. We'll find out later. But this is literally what happens to Moses. I mean, he goes from poverty to privilege. He goes from slavery to the royal family. What an incredible turn of events for Moses. It's interesting, one other note. Stephen says, Moses was mighty in words and deeds. Moses must have been very successful in his education. The Egyptians would have schooled him in science and in engineering. They were quite the engineers. The pyramids are a great example. And in literature and in astronomy and in chemistry and in law and in philosophy and on it goes. One of the mighty deeds that he performed that's mentioned by Josephus, the Jewish historian says that when Moses was around 30 years old, this young Egyptian prince led the Egyptian army against the Ethiopians and won a great victory. As a matter of fact, DeMille actually makes reference to that episode in his movie. Apparently, 40 years now elapse between verses 10 and 11. 40 years. Acts chapter 7 again, verse 23, Stephen tells us, "Now when Moses was 40 years old," that's how we know 40 years elapsed. "When Moses was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." Apparently, Moses knew all along his racial identity. And evidently, it produced some kind of personal crisis within his heart. For as the prince in the royal court, Moses knew he was in line to succeed the Pharaoh. He could one day be king over all Egypt. But Moses also knew that Egypt was not his home. And God put a stirring, God put a restlessness in Moses' heart.
That's all we have time for on this edition of Sandy Adams Radio. If you're interested in hearing today's message in Exodus again, or listening to more teachings from Pastor Sandy, we invite you to visit our website, sandyadams.org. You'll find a complete archive of his scripturally based messages, as well as a link to download our mobile app. While you're online, be sure to visit the shop. There you'll find several resources available for purchase to accompany your personal studies of God's Word, including books written by Pastor Sandy. Do you live in the Atlanta area, or will you be visiting soon? If so, we'd love to meet you in person. Come join us at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain on Sunday mornings for our time of worship, Bible study, and fellowship. Come just as you are. You'll find you're among friends here. You'll find service times, directions, and more information at sandyadams.org or give us a call at 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. When you call, please let us know how we can be lifting you up in prayer. Would you pray for us too? We can't do any of this without the loving guidance of our Creator. Thanks for praying for us. Pastor Sandy has more to share next time, so be sure to tune in again for Sandy Adams Radio.